Okay, folks, thank you for your indulgence. I had a little business to attend to with my minority lead here, but we don't quite have a quorum yet. When we do, we'll take a moment and do the minutes, but I'm informed we do have a quorum. So we will call the Transportation and Policy and Finance Committee meeting to order. Before I start with Mr. Shetnin and the new chair, just a couple things. In your packets, I noticed that we have committee rules and procedures. Members, if you got along with Representative Leader the last 4 years, you'll get along fine with me. They're pretty much the same rules. I don't think I even amended anything. So they seem to work just fine. So if you're used to that, you'll be used to this. Let's see, in your packets as well, you remember the last time we had a little discussion the chair did about our phasers, set them to stun. The good thing about being in the basement is they don't work down here anyhow. And shortly after that, one of my favorite lobbyists for League of Minnesota Cities had her phone go off. We all remember that. So we told her that by way of penance, if she would bring brownies, all would be absolved and forgiven. She begged off on the brownies, but if you look in your folder, there is a really cool new map from the League of Minnesota Cities. If it's okay with you guys, you accept the map as we'll absolve her of her cell phone mishap last time, okay?
So many carbohydrates.
Phasers set the stun. I don't want to interrupt the witness and be respectful of them when they're speaking to us. So with that, I think we have minutes in our packet, do we? Chair will entertain a motion for approval of the minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the minutes.
Representative Benson moves them. Discussion? Additions? Corrections? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. Rules and procedures. Members, today we're going to have a presentation from our friends at the Metropolitan Council regarding transportation, transit systems in the Metro District. I would like you to join me in welcoming the new chair appointed to the Metropolitan Council, former Ramsey County Commissioner Susan Haig, now Madam Chair. Welcome to the committee, and Judd, you too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here in my first meeting. I'm about 1 week into the job. So I brought support from the council staff who will be doing the bulk of the presentation today. But I'm very pleased to be here and to help educate particularly the new members of the committee who haven't had experience with the Metro Council. We have a PowerPoint presentation for you that you can follow along with us. I thought I'd give you just a quick background about the council before we move into the transit and transportation functions. There are 17 members on the council. I am appointed by the governor and I serve at large. The other 16 members serve in districts. The governor is now in the process of have selected a nominated committee, and we've sent letters out to the metropolitan legislators to give your recommendations on the candidates to be appointed to the Met Council. So would encourage those from the Twin Cities to give us your advice in that process. The council has several functions in addition to transit and transportation planning, so I want to make sure you understood those. It is the metropolitan planning organization for the seven county metropolitan area. And as a metropolitan planning organization, it does planning for transportation for short and long term. And it has two other important divisions, the Community Development Division and the Environmental Services Division. Community Development focuses on land use planning, the Livable Communities Act grants, on the Housing and Redevelopment Authority function, and on regional parks. So that's all in the community development part of the council. Then we also have a large environmental services division that works with the interceptive service system and treatment services, so water quality in the region. And then finally, the transportation functions are what we will be talking about today, and they are both as a planning organization and as a transit operator. So in the planning function, we are the Metropolitan Planning Organization. We do long-range transportation planning and then short-term federal funds programming. On the transit side, we provide for, contract for, and coordinate all metropolitan transit operations, both bus and rail, and we provide financial assistance to local transit providers, so kind of a multifunctional role. With that, I would like to call up a council staff member, Arlene, come on up, and to take over from here, and I'm going to sit and listen to all your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any questions or comments for Chair Hegg before she leaves the stand? Well, I say be kind to her today and let her get settled in first. Ms. McCarthy, welcome to the committee. We're being recorded. If you just mention your name for the tape, that would be appreciated.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Arlene McCarthy. I'm Director of Metropolitan Transportation Services at the Metropolitan Council. I'm going to be talking today about transportation planning and some of our other transit activities. As Chair Hague said, we are what's known as the MPO, acronym for Metropolitan Planning Organization for the Region. That's a federally required organization, and that allows us to perform federal functions such as the mandated planning. We're required to do a minimum of a 20-year range long-term transportation policy plan. The council just adopted their most recent plan in December of 2010. And we also work on a short-term plan, which is more of the next four-year look. It's known as the TIP. One thing you will notice is we're in kind of an acronym-heavy organization, so please ask me if I don't explain these acronyms. But we work on a four-year TIP, so we know what our work program is, so to speak, of construction over the next 4 years. Another federal program we put together is what's called the UPWP, the Unified Planning Work Program, and that essentially lays out our studies and research that we're going to do over the next few years. And then it's very important to note that we work with a lot of regional partners such as MnDOT and counties on major transportation studies, and that's both highway and transit studies. Working with the TAB, the Transportation Advisory Board, we allocate federal funds that come to this region, and that is done through a competitive solicitation. You might be familiar with CMAQ funds or STP, which is Surface Transportation Program funds. That's how those monies get allocated. We do a lot of coordinated activities, planning with MnDOT and our other partners. And then we also have a public input process that's very formal and lengthy. You will hear the council talk about how we are multimodal, and that means we look at these different modes, so to speak, of transportation. They're listed here. I won't repeat all of them, but we also do travel forecasting. We're responsible for the regional forecast model that predicts what ridership is and usages on roads. And as I mentioned, we do a lot of corridor studies, particularly with many partners. A few words about the Transportation Advisory Board, otherwise known as TAB. They are, per state statute, made up of elected officials from cities and counties. There are 33 members in total. There's also staff from state agencies such as MnDOT and MPCA and MAC. And there's also some citizen appointees for those modes that you saw on the preceding slide. This requirement of having locally elected officials on TAB fulfills a federal requirement needed to disperse those federal funds that we get. TAB recommends projects for funding, and then it comes to the Metropolitan Council for either approval or we send it back.
Ms. McCarthy, if you make it clear to the committee how these 33 people get on the TAB. Who does the appointing? Oh. Who's the authority that assembles them?
Yes, there is a variety. I can read them off here.
Please, if you would.
Yes. The Commissioner of Transportation or his or her designee, the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency or his or her designee, one member of the MAC appointed by the Commission, one person appointed by the MAC Council to represent non-motorized transportation, that would be bicycle and pedestrian, one person appointed by the Commissioner of Transportation to represent the freight transportation industry, two persons appointed by the council to represent public transit, then 10 elected officials of cities within the metropolitan area, including one representative from each first-class city, appointed by the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, one member from the county board of each county in the seven-county metropolitan area, appointed by the respective county boards, eight citizens appointed by the Metropolitan Council, one from each council precinct, And finally, one member of the Metropolitan Council appointed by the council.
It sounds like those requirements were assembled by the legislature.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
If I can just have an aside for the committee, I notice we're not all here yet, but members, when you're new, particularly the acronyms that go flying around can sometimes be dizzying. Mm-hmm. We're actually working on a cheat sheet for each of your packets that has all these acronyms and a brief description of what they mean. In the meantime, if you really are dying to know what it is, just catch my eye and we'll interrupt the testimony as they're moving on here. So thank you for humoring the committee.
Yes,
I appreciate
it. No problem. Thank you. Just a few more words here on TAV. They do have several subcommittees and policy committee, for example, and then there are also some technical staff committees that do a significant amount of work to then advise and make recommendations to the TAV committees. Now I'm going to move on to more of the operations side with the transit system. First, a recap of the providers of public transit here in our metropolitan area. Metro Transit provides the regular route bus, most of that in the region, and you'll hear more about that soon, as well as Hiawatha LRT. Metro Transit operates North Star Commuter Rail, working with an agreement with BNSF, and then they also provide regional support and rideshare services. My division, Metropolitan Transportation Services, operates Metro Mobility, which is the federally required ADA or Americans with Disability Act service. We also have a small share of contracted bus regular route, a regional dial-a-ride we call Transit Link, and then we have a small subsidized van pool program. And then we have the suburban transit providers, also known as the opt-outs, and they provide bus regular route. And we have more info on all of these. And now I'm going to turn it over, Mr. Chair, to Brian Lamb to speak to Metro Transit.
Thank you, Ms. McCarthy. Any questions for Ms. McCarthy before she leaves? Thank you. Mr. Lamb, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, I am Brian Lamb. I'm General Manager for Metro Transit. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to talk a little bit about Metro Transit in terms of what we do and most recently where we have gone in terms of our business. In 2010, the year just completed, we had 78 million rides, which was up 2.3% from 2009 and represented only the fourth time in the last 30 years that Metro Transit ridership has exceeded 78 million rides. Ridership was up about 2% last year, and it's also indicating the slowly improving economy. As you look at Metro Transit ridership over the course of the last several years, it really was going up when the economy was going strong, and then in late 2008 and into 2009, we took a dip along with the economy. We are by far the largest transit provider in the region, and we provide a better than 90% of the regular route ridership, and we're actually the 12th largest transit system in the country. Who are our customers? Actually, our customers overwhelmingly are people going to work and school. We do survey every other year our transit riders, and fully 78% are using transit to go to work or to school. We do have several large markets that are kind of our bread and butter, if you will, and one of them is, of course, downtown Minneapolis, where fully 40% of downtown Minneapolis workers use transit, getting to and from work. All of our, there's certain perceptions about transit riders, and not all of them are correct. And one of them is that that transit riders are by necessity transit riders. Well, actually, we know that 80% of our LRT riders, for example, and 56% of our bus riders actually have cars, but they choose to use transit on a daily basis. And that about 54% of our LRT riders have an average family income, household income of about $50,000 or more. And as I mentioned earlier, that every other year we do survey our onboard customers, and this last fully assembled survey in 2008, more than 90% indicated that they were fully satisfied with our service. We have several programs in place that really not only are kind of the backbone of Metro Transit operations, but really support the regional providers as well. And one of them is the MetroPass program. A MetroPass program is a direct program for the businesses in the region. And to date, we have 31,700 MetroPass holders, card holders, and over 244 companies. And back in 2004, we had we just climbed over 100 companies, and so the growth in terms of MetroPass companies has really been very steady over the course of the last few years, and represents about 7.8 million rides of that total 78 million rides. So about 10% of our total ridership are by MetroPass companies and holders.
Mr. Lamb, excuse me, when did you start that program, you said?
Mr. Chair, we actually started the MetroPass program in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. And in 2004 we actually achieved our 100th MetroPass company.
And of the 7.8 million rides, can you tell how many are on bus service and how many are on light rail? Or North Star?
Mr. Chair, we can tell. I don't have that number with me, okay. And I will get back to you with that
sure.
number.
Sure. Thank you.
In addition to the MetroPass program, we also have a variety of other employer-based programs, one of which is called the Transit Works programs, where over 330 employers are enrolled in Transit Works, which is a variety of transit-related packages. They might be more like the standard tokens, all the way up to different kinds of fare packages, monthly passes, etc. The last several years, we've really made some significant inroads as well with the university clientele as well. The UPass is our relationship with the University of Minnesota, and last year we had over 4 million riders on a quarterly basis. There's about 22,000 UPass holders through the University of Minnesota campus. We also have 48 colleges throughout the metropolitan area as part of our new program called the College Pass program, which is modeled on the UPass program and really had quite significant growth, and we're up to 1.5 million rides this last year. Mm-hmm. This last year we also started a new high school demonstration program with the city of Minneapolis, where we are focusing on children, high school age children who are actually out of their district in terms of their home district in parts of Minneapolis. They might live in North Minneapolis, but go to school in South Minneapolis. And we have filled in with in partnership with the Minneapolis public schools for a program that allows them to use public transit rather than the school bus program. Metro Transit has been kind of on the forefront of several service enhancements over the last couple of years, and perhaps the most noticeable is our improvements in downtown Minneapolis. As you may have seen, anyone who's been in downtown Minneapolis recently on 2nd and Marquette, we have recently completed our building-face-to-building-face reconstruction of 2nd and Marquette from Washington to 12th. Which allows essentially tripling the capacity of the buses in the peak hours, which allows the buses to kind of go through a skip-stop arrangement. Every other block, the different routes will go, and these are serving mostly express routes up and down Marquette and 2nd. In addition, we have made some improvements on Nicollet Mall. Nicollet Mall operations now is completely hybrid operations, and has really helped in partnership with the city of Minneapolis and the downtown businesses. And hybrids actually have lower emissions, but are also quieter than our standard buses. And so, particularly in the summer months where the outdoor dining is such an important commodity, having that partnership work is very important for us. In addition to that, one of our great successes this last year was really the opening up of the Twins ballpark and the modal split that goes along with that. Fully one in five people on many of the games at Twins would get there by going on a Metro Transit. We've had a long-standing success of 12 to 13% modal split for Hiawatha, We had between 1,700 and 2,000 riders per game on North Star for each one of those Twins games where we provided North Star service. And we had some very successful express park and ride services to and from the Twins games as well. We do have some other customer enhancements we were very excited about. Last year we unveiled our new website, which allows people to kind of more familiar with kind of the Google way of getting around to actually plug in where they're starting and where they're ending, and we'll put their automated trip together for them, and it's been hugely successful. And in fact, during the month of December, and I'm hoping we had 200,000 unique visitors to our website, which is an all-time record for us. We have real-time information that's available on every single one of our buses, so no longer you have to depend just on what time the bus is actually scheduled, but time you can call up your individual bus route, and they'll tell you what time it's actually going to arrive based on GPS technology so that we have for every one of our buses. We have moved forward with smart card collection. As I said, 75,000 people are carrying a go-to card right now in their wallets and using them for a variety of uses. It's a tap-and-go system, and it's really proved to be very effective. And fully 40% of Metro Transit's users are using the go-to card. And when we're talking about the Suburban Express utilization, it's closer to 80 to 85%. We also have unveiled just this last quarter a new Rides to Rewards program that over 8,000 people, have already enrolled to our Metro Transit's Rides to Reward program, which is set up very similar to other kinds of earn points kind of a thing, and it's a loyalty program and is off to a very good start. Metro Transit really has been in the forefront not only in the region but also in the country in terms of our Going Greener initiative. As I mentioned, we do have hybrid vehicles. We have approximately 900 or 97 of our 900 buses are hybrid vehicles right now. They get about 25% better fuel efficiency than our standard vehicles. In addition to that, we've really focused in terms of improvements on our facilities. We have, for instance, just this last month opened up our new transit station right in the middle of 35W at 46th Street in South Minneapolis. Many people don't realize that that new facility is actually has geothermal heating and cooling. And so it's really, I think, a long-term smart investment for us, and one that really kind of signs that we want to walk the talk in terms of being environmental good stewards.
Mr. Lamb, on the hybrid vehicles, can you describe, just because I'm curious, the what kind of hybrid it is? Or gas electric or diesel soy or natural gas? What exactly is it there?
Mr. Chair, in answer to its power source, it is all of our vehicles at Metro Transit are diesel soy. Mm-hmm. And we have, over the years, been, first of all, always ahead of the state mandate in use of biodiesel. We are currently using 5% because there continues to be some operational issues that show up in the winter months. Mm-hmm. But we have been as high in the summer months as 20% biodiesel usage, and have done so very successfully.
So your hybrid buses are biodiesel powered then? Or?
Mr. Chair, all of our buses are biodiesel throughout our fleet, including our hybrid buses.
Including the hybrids, okay.
Yes.
Well, proceed.
Oops. Let me just spend a minute talking about a couple of our modal operations. As you know, that we've had Hiawatha light rail in operation since 2004, where we opened it up in two separate phases. It's 12.4 miles from end to end, from Target Field out to the Mall of America. We have 19 stations. We actually set an all-time ridership this last year of 10.5 million rides. And as I said, it has been very successful for people for special events using it as well as on a day-to-day basis. This last year, we actually moved, we went through a program where we expanded all of our platforms to accommodate three-car train service. We have put them in service successfully. We haven't had any fleet, but we can actually build one, two, or three-car, what we call consists, link trains, so that we can better match the supply of service with the actual demand at various points. We do have 10 new cars on order to meet that increased demand over the course of the next few years. We have this last year in November of 2009 implemented the North Star Line, which goes essentially from Big Lake, Minnesota to downtown at Target Field. It's 40 miles. We operate at six out of six stations, and we operate essentially six round trips per day. In and out. It's unlike Hiawatha, which is really geared at frequency and has up to 7-minute frequency during the different times of the day. North Star is really exclusively for commuters. It's kind of geared around arrival times to for the standard work start times in downtown Minneapolis, and then the work quit times associated with that. Our 2010 ridership was 710,000, which is quite a bit, but less than what we were forecasting. And I think a big reason for that is that we actually had the, I'll say, the poor fortune of opening the same year where the economy took a noticeable dip in employment. As I said, it's a commuter line, and so this ridership is directly commensurate with the strength of the downtown Minneapolis employment. We have noticed, however, in the last month and a half, though, that that the ridership is actually up 14% from our base that was in late fall. So we're very pleased with that. One of the things that we know about North Star, both from our onboard surveys as well as from our customer comments, is that once we can get people on board that first time, they really enjoy that kind of stress-free commute. Regardless of the weather conditions, you can make that 40-mile trip in about 49 minutes, and a lot of people find that to be very attractive. So we are very hopeful, and we're going to continue to work very hard on North Star ridership moving forward.
Mr. Lamb,
yes, Mr.
on the capacity there with the six train sets that move, we've got 710 last year, but if the seats were, what's a reasonable number, 90%, 95% before it gets too crowded? What would that number be? What could it be without adding more train sets?
Mr. Chair, again, I think that in terms of physical capacity, each one of our trains, which have if we outfit them completely, have about four car consists that we would put together, each carrying about 200 or 225. So that puts you up towards, you could reasonably say that you could accommodate 4,000 people easily per day.
Okay.
So we have room to grow clearly within those six as we're right around half of that point.
All right. Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Lamb. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When a line like this is complete and we've built that infrastructure, how ought the bus service there to change? My understanding is there's still significant bus transportation on that very same corridor, and I've wondered if there were not coordination, if we weren't running buses at the same time we are running trains and use them only in the off hours.
Yeah, Mr. Lamb?
Whether you wouldn't shift some of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, actually, as you move out further, going back a few years, there were demonstration bus routes that were in place for, like, Elk River and stations beyond. And then when North Star Train started operations, those bus services ceased. As you get in closer, so let's say in the Fridley area or whatever, there are bus services that are available. And to be honest with you, I think that it's going to be very difficult to pull out the bus services that would not compete. For example, near our Fridley station, we have a Foley Park and Ride that essentially has 1,200 parkers on a daily basis using the bus service from Foley Park and Ride to downtown Minneapolis. As a commuter, you're thinking frequency is one of the determinants, and that's one of the reasons why Hiawatha is so successful, is You don't have to know the schedule. You just have to know that if I get to the platform soon enough, that a train will be by. That is the same sort of philosophy or mindset a person will approach that bus station that has buses leaving there during the rush hour every 3 minutes. To get people to transfer over to a station a mile and a half away that has every half an hour service, even if it is slightly, even if you took the price differential away, I'm not so sure that would be a good trade-off from a customer standpoint.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Hausman,
did we do something wrong in the planning? Why that park and ride somehow wouldn't serve both bus and rail?
Mr. Lamb?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I don't know if it's the planning per se, because you're kind of stuck with two immovable pieces. You had the Foley Park and Ride, which was built fully at least 15 years ago, if not longer. And then you have the BNSF main line. And those, neither one of those two facilities are going to be moving per se if you're going to try to provide direct service along that main line from Big Lake and perhaps points beyond.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be, you might be getting to this in your next set of slides, but I didn't see it right offhand, but Representative Hausman's question reminded me of park and rides. And, you know, my understanding is that park and rides for the bus system have been incredibly successful, and it's whether it's now or at some point in the presentation, if you could give us some data about park and ride usage in Twin Cities suburban communities and trends related to that, I think it would be very helpful.
And Mr. Lamb, now, or is it coming up shortly?
Mr. Chair, it is coming up shortly, and I think that was going to be a point that Ms. McCarthy was going
okay.
to cover.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Well, thank you for your portion of the presentation. Ms. McCarthy, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go over some more detail now on the other operating transit entity of the Council of MTS. As we described, we do both planning and transit ops. So on our transit ops, we have what we call contracted regular route, TransitLink dial ride, which is a relatively new regional dial ride service, and then our Metro Mobility or ADA services. And then we also pass through funding to all of the suburban transit providers, and that would include the motor vehicle sales tax funding, regional transit capital, and federal funds also that they earn.
Okay.
On the contracted regular routes, about a very small amount, 3.5% of the Met Council's transit regular route ride is delivered by contracted ops. So the regular route is anything that runs on a schedule. It would exclude ADA and dial-a-ride, for example. We provide some suburban circulator service, such as in Roseville, and we also do express service, such as from Forest Lake and Columbus and other communities. We do competitively procure this. We have about a half dozen contracts, and they typically have about a five-year term before we rebid them. Our ridership in 2009 was just under 2.5 million on these routes, and we estimate about 2.8 million here for 2010. The ridership has grown quite a bit between 2000 and 2010. That's primarily because we eliminated some lower ridership service over the course of that time and reinvested the service into higher performing routes. Other parts of it is just growth in ridership, however. As I mentioned, we restructured the Dial-A-Ride program in the metropolitan area, and we just completed that in 2010. What we did was an initiative where in the past, we had dial-a-ride in some locations where regular route existed, and that was considered a duplication. And then there were other parts of the 7th County Metro, primarily out in the more further reaches of the 7 counties, that had no transit option at all. And so what we did is we restructured the services so that we eliminated duplication. In other words, if you had regular route bus or rail, that was your transit choice, and we do not provide dial-a-ride in those locations. And then we reinvested all of our dial-a-ride resources out in the areas where there is not a regular route option. And so we've received, quite frankly, very good feedback on that. The other thing we do is we coordinate very much with the fixed route. So if somebody wants to go all the way into downtown Minneapolis, we don't drive them on Dial-A-Ride all the way in. We bring them to a convenient regional transfer point, such as many of these major park-and-ride facilities or other transit centers. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to use our resources widely.
Ms. McCarthy,
and we use, excuse me.
On the Dial-A-Ride thing, I'm familiar with what with the DARTS program in Dakota and with what we've done in Carver-Scott with merging ours together. Is that dispatched by the counties then, and then they apply to you for partial reimbursement, or how is the fare collected and the revenue split on that?
Mr. Chair, the service is 100% funded by the Metropolitan Council, and we have five contracts, and that's what this map shows here.
Okay.
Those are the contracted areas. Again, the service is provided where there is not regular route. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we have a direct contract with Scott and Carver County, and basically we reimburse them for their costs after fare revenues are credited. The other four contracts were all competitively procured. Scott Carver was a little bit of a different situation. We had some options on how we could deliver this service, and we asked the counties and how they would like to do that. And so we have slightly different arrangements, but the fundamental situation is that the council funds it 100% and we contract for it to be delivered.
But there is some fare box recovery with it.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Good. Yes. Thank you. Before we proceed, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted a little bit more explanation on this Dial-A-Ride program. I'm not that familiar with it. Mm-hmm. The county's own vans or cars or buses or something, and then you call in and it'll come out to your house and pick you up?
Ms. McCarthy?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, the council also owns all the vehicles, and then we provide them to the contractor providing the service, and they maintain them under an agreement with us. And then there is a one of the major accomplishments with our restructuring last year is we have one number across the whole region for people to call, and then depending on where you're located, you get routed to the appropriate provider. The providers provide the dispatch services also, but we provide the technology and the system for them to use so we can collect all of the data for our reporting and things like that. But yes, they call and make a request for a trip, and if we have the resources available, and I think that's an important point to make, is that Dial-A-Ride is, it is not unlimited in its funding. We have a budget, and if we have the resources available, then yes, we provide a ride, and it picks them up at their location they want to be picked up at and takes them to their destination. Again, if part of the trip can be handled on regular route, then we transfer somebody at a major transit transfer facility, and you pay your fare for Dial-A-Ride.
Representative Leidiger.
Thanks, sir. Does this pay for itself, this Dial-A-Ride program?
No, it does not. The subsidy per passenger on Dial-A-Ride, the subsidy covers about 25%, the fare covers about 25% of the cost.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Ms. McCarthy, thank you. Proceed.
The ADA service, the branding name we have for that in this region is the Metro Mobility Service. This, unlike Dial-A-Ride, where we have no obligation to ensure a ride is available, per federal ADA rules, we must provide rides in all areas 3/4 of a mile either side of all-day regular route service. Not express service, but all-day service. In other words, persons with disabilities must have the same opportunity to have transit service as those people who can access all-day regular route service. We provide door-through-door service. In other words, we will go to the door and escort the person onto the bus, and then when they get to their destination, escort them through the door of their destination. That is a state statute requirement, the door-through-door service. And as I mentioned, we are, by federal requirements, have a zero denial goal on this service. It has a subsidy similar to Dial-A-Ride.
Ms. McCarthy, there is a fee for service that covers a portion of the ride. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The fee for Metro Mobility, I'm trying to remember if it's, I think it's $4.50 during the peak period and $3.50 in the off peak. I might be slightly off on that,
okay,
in that ballpark. And then the suburban transit providers, they have 12 communities. This was established back in the 80s, where we have 12 communities who control their own transit service. They pretty much provide their service through their own procurement and awarding with private contractors. They have a variety of buses and sizes and service types. But to summarize, there on the map, starting from the top in the blue, is the city of Maple Grove, then the city of Plymouth. Their program is called Plymouth MetroLink. Then in the orange is Southwest Transit, and that is a joint powers board representing the cities of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska. Then in purple is the city of Shakopee. In yellow is the city of Prior Lake. And finally, the green area is Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and they are also a joint powers board made up of the cities of Apple Valley, Rosemount, Eagan, Burnsville, and Fresh.
Great. And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Shetland.
My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and I will briefly walk you through the transit funding portion of Metropolitan Area Transit. First, I'd like to go through our operating funding sources. You will see we participate in the motor vehicle sales tax. We state fiscal year 2012. We will receive 36% of the statewide MVEST. That was done through the constitutional amendment and then by statute. We also receive state general funds. We receive federal funds, and those formula capital funds are used for preventative maintenance in our operating budget. So you will see those show up in our operating budget. However, they are just used for maintenance in our day-to-day operations.
Okay.
We also, one of our funding sources is fares, which is passenger fares, and then local and other sources, and you will see CTIB, the County Transitway Improvement Board. They participate in the transitway fundings, and as you'll be hearing from them shortly. And then we also receive some revenue from advertising. As you can see here, our calendar year 2011 operating budget is $405 million. Of that, 93% of that revenue comes from the motor vehicle sales tax, passenger fares, the state general fund, and federal fund. The local revenue, as I mentioned before, comes from CTIB. We also receive some from Sherburne County for the North Star Rail Line, and we also receive some funding from CTIB on two busways, the Cedar Avenue busway and the I-35W busway. And under the expenses, when you include North Star and Hiawatha, you can see that Metro Transit makes up about 78% of that total budget. I'd like to talk briefly about the transit capital funding sources as well. The first being state bonds. Those are state general obligation bonds. The second is the regional transit capital. Third being federal funds. The fourth is the sales tax that the counties impose, the CTIP sales tax. And then lastly, the regional rail authorities and other local dollars that go into funding transit purposes. And the last slide is regards regional transit capital. And these are the source of capital funds for our basic transit system. The legislature authorizes these bonds almost every year. We generally are found in the public finance article of the tax bill. The debt service is paid with property taxes levied by the council. And the levy is paid by those communities that that levy the transit capital levy.
Mr. Shetland,
Mr. Chair,
to be clear, these bonds, do they originate in this committee? I believe they do. The requests start here, and then we move them through to the appropriate committee.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. It's been handled a number of ways over the years, but in the past, this committee has heard the council's request for regional transit capital bonds, and then it is forwarded to the tax committee, and I would figure that we'll probably go that same route again this year. The council is working with the administration on bringing forward a request for this year as well.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the dollar amount generated by the regional transit capital?
Mr. Chetland.
By that taxing authority.
Mr. Chair, sure. Representative Hausman, it's about $33 million a year.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hausman?
That, of course, is a holdover from some other time, but I mean, I think if everybody looks at the map, this is the strangest kind of taxing we do. Only the people living in that green line are taxed.
Yes, members, you want to take a look at that and hold that thought, because we're having a fascinating discussion over the next couple of weeks about that issue, and others, I'm sure. Can I go to Representative Morrow now? Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope part of that fascinating discussion will be the counties that are outside both those lines as we talk about capital bonds for transit. And, Mr. Chair, I hope we're going to be hearing testimony on how Greater Minnesota Transit is being funded and whether we're looking to local entities outside these counties to fund transit improvements, or whether the state will be taking that on.
We'll be having that discussion at another point. Today, though, we've dedicated it just to Mr. Shatton and his team. But yes, that's a good point. We will have that discussion also. And before you came in, I did tell the members all these acronyms and all these formulas and everything. We're going to have a little cheat sheet for everybody's folder so you can kind of keep up with the conversation as it moves along. Okay, we're ready to get back on track. Mr. Shetland?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple brief notes.
Sure.
The levy that we use for these bonds is for transit capital purposes, including bus, park and ride facilities, customer facilities, garages, and capital equipment. We use these bonds because they're a shorter-term bond, where we would use general obligation bonds for real long-term capital projects. And the other point I would like to make is that all providers in the region are eligible. It's not just Metro Transit or the opt-out providers. This is for the Dial Ride service. This is for Metro Mobility and the contracted routes. So I just want to make sure that everybody knows that request, when we come to the legislature, it is not just for Metro Transit purposes alone. It is for all metropolitan area transit providers.
Good, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Aaron, I think while you're swooping your slides, Aaron is the, I think, the thrust of what Representative Hausman's comments are, because I see all of Dakota County and all of Carver and Scott are covered by, say, Dial-A-Ride service, which benefits from this transit capital levy. We used to call it transit taxing district, I think, at one time, didn't we?
Yes,
so,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's a discussion we need to be chatting about here going forward. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this back to Ms. McCarthy.
Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I'll just note that, yes, we informally still call it the Transit Taxing District, but state statute actually set which communities are in the Transit Taxing District, and we subsequently had four communities join, and so we had to call it something else. And so that's how come we now call it Transit Capital Levy Communities. So there's just a slight legal reason for that change.
I see. On this map on page 14, are those new communities reflected on the new boundaries on this? I think they are, if Lakeville's part of it.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The four communities that have joined are Lakeville, Forest Lake, Columbus, and Maple Plain.
Outstanding. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to go over some statistics here on transit. First, on ridership, we've summarized here Metro Transit Bus. You can see makes up the majority of transit ridership in our region. Metro Transit Rail, starting with Hiawatha in 04, is the yellow portion of your bar. And then the other programs are in green, and that would include the suburban transit providers, the contracted services Met Council operates, ADA, Dial-A-Ride, all those other services.
Okay.
Now on to the park and rides, and there was some questions on this earlier. We have had quite a bit of success with our park and rides. We have almost pretty much doubled the capacity of park and rides around the region over the last decade. We are finally catching up with demand. On the other hand, ridership, when it was strong in 2008 due to gas prices, if we had a situation like that again, we would probably start having some overflow situations at some of our park and rides again. But many of our large park and rides are full. We've listed a few of them here. Southwest Station, which is down in the area of Southwest Transit. Maple Grove, this is the Arbor Lake Park and Ride, for those of you familiar, is full. The Foley Park and Ride, which is located in Coon Rapids, that's over 1,200 spaces and it is full. MBTA's facility in Apple Valley at 157th Street is full, and that's at about 800 spaces. On the LRT side, our Fort Snelling lots are full. And then in Burnsville, the transit station there, which is the largest of the facilities at about just under 1,400 spaces, is also essentially full. We've shown here on the map our larger facilities. All of the dots on this map are facilities that are at least 100 spaces, but many of them are much larger than that. And I think it's important for you to know that these are regional facilities. When we cite facilities, as General Manager Brian Lamb explained, larger facilities that have a higher frequency of service are really more attractive to people than a small park and ride that only has three trips a day. People really like the fact when a bus comes very frequently in the peak. And of course, this is focused on express commuter service. But what we have found is more successful park and rides are larger facilities that are regional in nature. They're situated on a highway corridor, for example. They serve multiple communities. They do not serve just one city. They are definitely targeted at that corridor, commuters coming down that corridor. So we've really had a very good, I think, regional strategy, the suburban transit providers and Metro Transit, in really targeting a market with a good quality service at all of these facilities. I'm now kind of combining a few things we've talked about here. This map shows the inside area is the transit taxing district, and then what you'll see are red dots that are outside the transit, or I should use my own terminology, that communities that pay the transit levy, that are outside of that but still within the seven county metro are the red dots you see here. And we do a license plate survey of park and rides every other year, so we can plot where folks are coming from when they park at these facilities. And based on that data, we know that 10% of people that park at park and rides are outside where the levy is paid but inside the seven county metro. Furthermore, this is a look beyond the seven county metro, and 15% of all of our users that park and ride actually come from beyond the seven county metro. Now, obviously, you can see a heavy concentration through the North Star corridor. Of course, that's a targeted market, and we would expect to see heavy usage there. It's just interesting to look at this on the northwest, kind of the bunch of dots up in the northwest is St. Cloud. So you can see there are quite a few people who drive from St. Cloud down to park and ride facilities along the North Star corridor or farther in. So that's just some information that always seems to fascinate folks. And then we wanted to finish up, Mr. Chair, we thought this would be a nice segue to CTIV following after us to speak to our transitway vision. As I mentioned, the council did just recently adopt an updated transportation policy plan, and while the focus of that was on roads, not transitways, we do continue to address our transitway vision. And I'm going to actually go to the map while I summarize this. This is the map out of our policy plan. And the red lines, there are seven of them that are solid red, and those are transitways that are either in operation today or they are under construction, such as Central, or in design, either preliminary engineering or final design. And the most recent added to that group was the Southwest LRT corridor. The council amended that in June of this past year, I believe. The next group I'd like to highlight are what we call the candy stripe lines. They're red and white. The idea there is that we expect them to become solid red someday. And those are eight corridors that we are recommending as definitely having potential for transitways, and so they're recommended to go through a study process to determine what the solution should be in each of those corridors. And I'll get into that process in just a moment. Then you'll see nine corridors in blue, and those are what we call arterial BRT corridors. These are more in the urban core, on streets such as Central Avenue in Minneapolis or Nicollet Avenue in Minneapolis. In St. Paul, we're talking about Snelling and East and West 7th Streets. These corridors today are extraordinarily strong bus corridors. They carry a very large number of riders today. And the idea is those corridors are probably should have a higher level of service to grow that ridership even more. And then the last group I'd like to focus on are the gold or yellow lines, and these are express bus corridors that have transit advantages, and we have 13 of them shown, and these are focused, as the name implies, on the commuter market express routes, and most of these, or all of these, have some type of a dedicated transitway. It can range from a hot lane, like on 394 and the newly opened hot lane on 35W south of Minneapolis, or shoulder lanes, the bus-only shoulder lanes you might have seen. And then just want to end here with the project development process. It takes quite a bit to deliver these transitway projects, and this is the most typical delivery method. There are exceptions and different ways to deliver projects, but we wanted to give you an idea. The first box there on your left speaks to the early corridor planning. That's what we do with the transportation policy plan. In other words, that map that you just saw. We do a high-level analysis to identify potential corridors, knowing they need much more analysis to determine what, if any, transitway they should become. So then we move into the alternatives analysis phase. This is typically in this region led by the counties. They also often are the funder of this phase. This can take often 2 years, so it's a lengthy process. And that's looking at the various modes and alignments or corridors that a transitway could take and narrowing that down. And what we do at the end of that phase is the council adopts into the policy plan what's called the locally preferred alternative. That's a federal term, LPA for short. And that really, once an LPA is selected, it means the project has been defined. What are we going to build? So, for example, last year the council adopted for Southwest Corridor, they adopted the alignment, I think, you know, the Kenilworth alignment, and that the mode would be LRT. So that now says we have a project that has been defined, and it can move forward into preliminary engineering. So alternative analysis takes usually about 2 years. Preliminary engineering is usually 1 to 2 years. Then we move into final design, where you produce those bid documents. That's usually about a year. And then construction is 3 to 4 years, depending upon the project. You add that all up, from AA on, you're talking at least 8 years to deliver these projects. So it is a lengthy endeavor.
NEPA, for the committee's edification, remind us what NEPA again.
Yes, that is the NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, I believe. I always want to say Protection Act, too, but I believe it is Policy Act.
Okay, yes, those of us who were on the first committee this morning probably had a little discussion about that whole thing with permitting and reviews and timelines.
Mm-hmm.
NEPA. Representative Leidiger, do you still have a question or
comment? Yes, sir, I do.
Please.
This Met Council's huge. What is the total value of your assets? And I guess more specific question, those park and rides, do you own that property?
Ms. McCarthy, do you want to take that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. The park and ride facilities are, for the most part, owned by the Metropolitan Council, or suburban transit providers own the facilities that are located in their areas of service. There are some cases where we lease facilities. We might have a facility at a shopping center, for example, so we have some kind of a lease agreement. The Running Aces Park and Ride up in Columbus is a recent example. We lease space through them. So there's various different arrangements.
The bulk,
though, yes,
is owned
by the council. Yes.
Mr. Leiger?
So then that plus the buses and the what is this? How large are you as an organization?
That might be a whole other committee meeting, but Ms. McCarthy, would you like
to take a stab at it?
I'm not really comfortable taking a stab at that number.
What you mean,
Mr. Chair? Why don't I work with our folks, and we'll provide that to you for the whole committee. I will. That's an interesting question. I don't know if we've ever been asked that before, Representative. So I will work with our folks at in Arlene's shop and over at Metro Transit with Brian, and we'll provide that to the committee.
No, I assume that the thrust of the question is on the transit operations, because they also run a couple of sewer plants.
Yes, that's right. I
have a nice building downtown.
I don't know about that. Yeah,
that's another committee.
Yes.
I don't want to.
Okay.
next week.
Well, at any organization, I know the value of my company.
Yeah.
And this is, for many years, it's just grown. It'd be an interesting figure to understand.
Yeah, it would. And let's let Mr. Shetnan work on getting that number back to us, and we can get an accurate number, some a little more integrity we can do off the top of our head here at the moment. So
thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or anything? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the radar went a little piece on slide figure 7-43, I think it was one before this slide.
What page was it on?
Oh, page 18 in our handout packet, okay. But it was one just, oh, there you go. All right.
That one.
There's these nice little gray lines at the very end called MnDOT Phase 1 High Speed and Intercity Passenger Rail Projects. Could you inform the committee what is entailed in Phase 1? And how much taxpayer dollars are being expended in Phase 1.
Which one of you would like to address that?
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Biskins, I see that the folks from MnDOT are here. It may be more appropriate for them to speak to that. I don't know if they're prepared to do that or not.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Biskins.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Shetnan, then, even though these appear to originate within the metro area, the Metropolitan Council is not involved in any part of these projects?
Mr. Shetnan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, these projects are led by the Department of Transportation. The Council works with them as far as the impacts to the metropolitan area and how it would function with our system. However, the real heavy lifting and the responsibilities for the intercity rail projects really lie in the duties of the of MnDOT.
Well, Mr. Shetnan, is this referring to the work that was been done by the High Speed Rail Passenger Coalition that's been meeting for what, a year and a half now or so?
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right.
Representative Morrow's waving his hand. Maybe he could speak to it.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Representative Hausman was part of these meetings as well. I believe this refers to the state rail plan process that this committee put into place over the last few years, and that document identified high-priority lines. I believe there are three or four of them, and Representative Biskins, I know that the Mankato Twin Cities was one of those. It did the study. I believe Representative Beard, you were at those meetings as well, looking at potential ridership, looking at existing lines, existing freight lines and like, and try to set a priority system. Chair Beard, I think I'm correct in recalling there is not money allocated to do these right now, or I think maybe Representative Biskins asked how much is being spent now, but rather this a cost has been drawn out, but I don't believe there are immediate plans spending money today, but rather saying what money would be needed to make these lines a reality.
At another time, members, we're going to have the high-speed passenger rail team that MnDOT's been heading up come and tell us about their activities and what they have in mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I can conclude my thought, then if we've got overlapping jurisdiction of moving people through transportation systems and two very large entities, then probably we should consider creating a third entity, which would be a planning entity to help make sure that these entities align in what they're doing. Oh, wait, that was the Met Council's original role, was it not?
Well, Representative Biskins, I hear what you're saying, and you'll probably want to put on your calendar to be here on to hear the discussion about transit governance that will be coming up the 21st, I think, on this committee. Well, this coming Monday, whatever day it is, 24th, I guess, yeah. You can come on the 21st. We'll be here the 24th.
Maybe you should come on the 24th.
I'm messing with him. I'm sorry, members. Further questions or comments on this portion before we hear from our friends at CTIP? Thank you, Representative Morrow, for shedding a little light on and reminding us of that rail planning process that, that we launched from here a while back. Madam Chair, thank you for coming down
today.
I look forward to working with you, and you got good people to come over here and keep us informed. So, Ms. McCarthy, Mr. Shetnan, and members, we now have Peter McLaughlin, the chair of the County's Transportation Improvement Board. Mr. McLaughlin, welcome. I don't know how deep your presentation is today, but I'm sure we'll be asking you to come back at some point in the future as well.
Doug's going to help find the presentation there.
Members, the page is handing out a presentation that Chair McLaughlin will be working from. And while this is settling, who's here from MnDOT with the passenger rail stuff? That Dave, are you up there? Scott, do you feel compelled to say anything to further illuminate what Representative Morrow just said? Good. You got it covered? Good. Thanks. Okay, do we all have the presentation in front of us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm
Mr. Chairman,
Peter McLaughlin.
Welcome.
I am chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority and appearing here today as chair of the county's Transit Improvement Board, the treasurer of the county's Transit Improvement Board. Commissioner Jim McDonough is here. I've got a stick. I thought this thing had already been loaded up. There's a stick in my briefcase. In the front, if somebody could bring that. I'm sorry.
Would you like us to take a moment? Would you like to continue from the handout, or should we wait for Mr. Schreiber to find the stick?
I can get it loaded up.
There we go.
Here we are. Okay.
So I'll start through the presentation, though, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
In light of time. The County's Transit Improvement Board was created based on statutory direction that was provided with the now 2 3/4-year-old transportation bill. The statutory direction provided at that time was to invest in transitways through county-imposed sales taxes, the money of which would be deposited in a single account and distributed through a joint powers board that would be created among the participating counties.
There you go.
Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. See this page down three.
There we go.
You want me to do it for you? Good.
Thank you very much. And so that was the direction. We were to seek advice from local governments through a GEARS committee that was comprised of county representatives, city representatives, and the Metropolitan Council. We were to maximize federal investment in transit in the state of Minnesota. And we were to operate with, we were trying to minimize administrative expenses, and there was a specific statutory limitation of 0.75% of the tax proceeds from the sales tax that could be used for administrative purposes. That was the direction provided by law. Our vision was to create a network of connected transitways that would be integrated with other elements of the transportation system to move people efficiently and safely, mitigate congestion, enhance development and our economic competitiveness as a region and a state, and to improve the sustainability and livability of the region.
Chair McLaughlin, we have a question. Representative Biskin.
Thank you. Chair McLaughlin, just real quick, on the first slide, you bullet two, seeks advice of local governments through GEARS. What's GEARS?
It is a committee, an advisory committee that was provided by statute that was to be comprised of county representatives, city representatives, and the Metropolitan Council. And their role was to advise the county's Transit Improvement Board on the investments that it wished to make with the sales tax fund. It was a way in which to involve cities in the deliberations about what the priorities for regional transit investment ought to be, but didn't put them on the governing board of the county's Transit Improvement Board because they hadn't imposed the tax. The county board that imposed the tax.
Specifically, what do you know what the acronym means? Can you recall?
It's later in the presentation.
Oh, well, we'll get there. Okay, we'll wait till we get there then.
And
it's the grant evaluation and
something.
Something.
It's coming.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. Representative Biskin's follow-up.
Yeah, well, and Chairman, so that entity does now exist, and you do have that relationship?
We do. It has operated as provided by statute. That organization has provided advice on each of the three grant rounds that the county's Transit Improvement Board has gone through. They've reviewed all of the grants. Mm-hmm. They have provided a recommendation to the county's Transit Improvement Board before the grants were finally approved, as provided by statute.
Thank you. Okay, proceed. Thank you.
So this is the vision, and this map, as you look at it, it is very similar to the Metropolitan Council's map that you saw. We don't have the candy stripes on there as much, and we don't include the arterial busways, but these priority corridors are very similar to the priority corridors that were identified by the Metropolitan Council. And the law requires that any grants that the county's Transit Improvement Board confers have to be consistent with the Metropolitan Council's transportation plan. And we have done that consistently in our three rounds of grants. And so there's been a close working relationship between the two organizations, and the plans, the visions are very, very similar. There's some a few differences on the edges, but in general, the plans have been consistent about what the regional priorities ought to be.
Okay.
So that what resulted after the statute was passed was that five of the seven counties in the metro area that were eligible to participate in the county's transit in creating this joint powers board, five opted to do so. Those five are Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties. They represent over 90% of the seven county metro's population and over 95% of the sales tax revenue generated in the region. Each of these county boards voted to impose a quarter cent sales tax for expanding transitways, and the transitways being LRT, BRT, and commuter rail lines, not high-speed rail. LRT, BRT, if you think BRT, that's what's evolving on 35W and the Cedar Avenue busway, and then commuter rail, that would be North Star, would be the example. Current projections of revenue from the five counties, that projection is $89 million a year. That's what we built into our financial model at this time. Performance in 2010 was $91 million, so we met expectations. And since 2008, nearly $317 million in grants have been awarded for transitway development, for construction, and for operation of transitways in the metropolitan area.
Chairman McLaughlin, we quickly do the math in our heads, and I'm wondering how 89 a year equals 317.
That's, Mr. Chairman, you're very quick.
Okay.
In late 2010, the board, we tried to operate, our first two rounds, we tried to operate on a cash basis, and we did that completely. But because of the obligations, primarily the obligations for Central Corridor, in which we are in the financial plan that went to the federal government, County's Transit Improvement Board was going to be contributing on the order of $107 million in 2011, $98 million in 2012. So upfronting a lot of the money for Central Corridor is coming from CTIP. And so we issued $110 million in bonds, and I'm going to cover that
in a moment.
It was our first issuance of bonds.
Okay.
And that's how the numbers add up.
Okay, thank you.
So what we created was five counties joining. Scott and Carver opted not to participate. They did, however, they were invited to continue to participate. They participated in the development of the Joint Powers Agreement. They opted not to join. Both counties were invited to send non-voting meetings, and they have done so and have been regular participants in our meetings throughout our time of existence. So we had five counties enacting the tax. The County's Transit Improvement Board sets criteria, and we award the grants from these sales tax revenues. The Grant Evaluation and Ranking Systems Committee, there's your gear,
there it is.
I apologize, has advised us each and every time as we've gone through this. And the grant awards that we have made in our three rounds of grants have been for capital and for operating expenses for these transitways, which are major investments in transit, in particular corridors.
Mm-hmm.
If you look over the last decade or so, federal funds have, over $950 million in federal funds have come into this region and state for improvements to transit, in this area. We have $45 million in federal money from Cedar Avenue Busway as one example, North Star $178 million in federal funds. You had $412 million for Hiawatha. And there, if you look at Central Corridor, which is next in line and the full funding grant agreement is imminent within the next several months from the federal government, that will be a commitment from the federal government of in excess of $450 million. And if Southwest were to come through, that would be a commitment of in excess of $600 million. And so we are, one of the things we're supposed to do is to elicit federal funds. We're looking at almost $1 billion that's been brought in, some before CTIB, but there's another $1 billion on the way for Central and then for Southwest if those were to go forward. But, so we're trying, we believe that we can bring these resources in. The New Starts money, which is what we're using for North Star or for Central, that is money that cannot be used for, that's not for highway improvements. That is for transit improvements around the country. If we don't use the funds, those funds will go to other regions around the country with which we compete. And there's a long list of projects around the country that are trying to get these funds. Here's the sales tax revenue. As I said, $91 million in 2010. Outperformed 2009 just slightly. We're pleased that we're just ahead of budget a little bit on that so that we can continue to meet the commitments that we've made. The bonds, Mr. Chairman and members, we issued there were $110 million in bonds issued. We pledged 99.25% of CTIB's revenues in order to get the best possible bond rating. The overall rate that we received on these bonds was 3.9%. Which is a number I didn't think I was going to see on in my adult life, but I was very pleased with that. We saved nearly $3 million, estimated present value savings of $3 million by having Hennepin County, which has a AAA credit rating and has been in the finance markets for decades, Hennepin County issued the bonds on behalf of CTIB, and CTIB then pledges the revenues from the sales tax to pay those bonds off. But the estimate was we saved almost $3 million because Hennepin County stepped forward and assumed the responsibility to actually do the issuance and participate in the credit markets. These bonds were designed to meet the 2011 and 2012 capital grant commitments, primarily, as I indicated, for Central Corridor. This allows us to keep Central Corridor on time and on budget, which it is, and we're confident it's going to stay on time and on budget. And these bonds, none of the revenues from these bonds can be used for operating grants. The annual grant process is governed by a number of documents. First, the statute. Second, the joint powers agreement by which the five counties join together to pool these resources. There's a transit investment framework that the county's Transit Improvement Board adopts each year that looks at the long-term priorities for funding of transit, making sure that we have a plan. The annual financial review and capacity estimate matches resources with the demands on the resources. We do that very carefully with the help of Springstead and Associates as our financial advisor. We pass an annual resolution that establishes a solicitation process. People wish to receive these grants. And then we set eligibility criteria for the grants. I would say CTIB doesn't own any property. It doesn't operate any rail lines. We are there to raise funds to expand transitways, and so our primary function is to distribute these grants to expand the transit system in the metropolitan area. We've been trying to keep it lean and mean and perform that function in a cost-effective way, and I think we've done that. We also have made funding commitments. We provide annual grants, but we've also made commitments to various lines and to Washington County. The Central Corridor, we made a commitment of up to $300 million for our whole commitment to the line.
Ms. Lachlan, would that be capital?
That's capital.
For the capital, okay.
Yes. And that $300 million commitment, we've actually, with our grants that we approved in 2010, we've already committed two-thirds of the funds that we need to meet that up to $300 million commitment. And the beauty of that commitment, Mr. Chairman and members, is when you're competing for federal funds, mm-hmm.
They want to know if you've got their local match in place.
Sure.
By that official action of committing $300 million, we then could have a solid plan along with the commitments from the state of Minnesota and from from the county rail authorities to actually go to the federal government and say, we've got our ducks in line, our financial ducks in line, and we received a very high rating on our local financial plan. It was one of the highest, or if not the highest rating of any local financial plan in the country, because we had these commitments that we could make. In addition, we made a commitment to Washington County, a special commitment to them, that they would receive 3% of the revenues coming from the tax. That was guaranteed, and we have, because their projects were not as ripe as the projects in some of the other areas. So we gave them the exception to the direction that we want the funds to be spent on capital, not on planning. Mm-hmm. So they actually have been doing planning in the Gateway Corridor. They've also made some investments in some park and rides that are in place now. But that was a commitment to Washington County because of their unique circumstances. And we've made a commitment to fund half of the operating expenses of these of the transit ways in which we invest. So half of the operating costs for these lines we're paying for. And that was moving it off of the property tax. Okay. So the grant awards, these are the totals: $248 million in capital grants over the three rounds of grants, and $69 million in operating. It includes the first year commitment that was included in the statute, contribution from CTIB's first year revenues of $30.78 million to Metro Transit for operating expenses of Metro Transit. So these are some of the projects that we funded, and these projects are, as you can see, they're across they go across the region. They also include a variety of modes. It's bus rapid transit, it's light rail, it's commuter rail. We've got the studies that I mentioned in Washington County, and we also gave Washington County the ability to purchase express bus service with the proceeds from their revenue. So we're building out the system across the region. These lines, every one of these lines is on the Met Council's map. Every one of these lines and every one of these investments has been deemed to be consistent with the Met Council's long-term plan. So the expectations when the law was passed from the legislature and the stakeholders included property tax relief, covering the operating costs of these transitways. So half of the operating costs of these transitways is no longer on the property tax. It's being paid for with sales tax. We want to have reduced reliance on state bonding for these projects. And I've got a little chart here. The top pie chart shows the North Star model. This was before CTIP. In which case, it's a New Starts project. That's the federal program. Half of the money comes from the federal government. A third of North Star's capital expenditures came from the state. 17% came from the county rail authorities in the form of property tax. With the creation of the county's Transit Improvement Board, these numbers changed dramatically. Federal government stayed at half, but the state share dropped from a third of the cost down to 10%. So less than one-third of what the state used to contribute is now being contributed by the state. The rail authorities, through their property tax, that dropped from 17% to 10%, so that was almost halved. So we provided relief from the property tax. And then 30% comes from the county transit improvement board. So you look at this, 40% of the cost of these projects, 80% of the non-federal share is coming from county-based entities. The other things that the stakeholders expected was expansion of the system. And we have been investing in the expansion of the system. There was a directive in the statute that said that these revenues could not supplant existing expenditures by the Metropolitan Council of the state. So it had to be, again, committed to expansion of the system. And there was a clear expectation among the folks, and the folks who were for this included various advocacy groups, but the business community stepped forward up to and including the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. They wanted construction. They didn't want studies. They wanted to make sure that we were putting service on the street, and I think we have done just that. We've successfully fulfilled the expectations in the statutory direction, kept our promises. We've advanced these consensus priority projects of the region using sales tax revenue. Central was the consensus next, and by statute was supposed to be the second LRT project. Central does not get built, would not be getting built without this sales tax money. There was no business model that was going to carry it through. So that was next. Southwest is has been identified by the Met Council as the next LRT line. We've expanded transit ridership. We believe we've contributed to economic competitiveness of the region and the state, and we've delivered good value to the state and the region. And if you think about Hiawatha, with over 10 million riders last year, one line, over 12% of all the riders on the Metro Transit system, and now we're trying to mesh these things together. You're going to have Central tying in. You're going to be able to, and North Star, they'll all be tied together at the ballpark station. That's going to provide some synergy. One of the things that contributed to Hiawatha's growth in ridership was North Star coming in and delivering riders to it. So, excuse me, Mr. Chairman. So we think that this vision is a positive vision for economic competitiveness in the region. We think we fulfilled the direction that was provided by statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I have.
Chair McLaughlin, are we able to define how many end-to-end rides come in North Star and jump on Hiawatha? I'm just curious.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Mr. Chairman.
The riders that are handed off from either North Star to Hiawatha or vice versa, is that quantifiable yet?
That's a Met Council question.
And I'm just curious.
They can get that for you.
All right.
Well, they can get that for you.
Yeah, if you can, I would be interested in knowing how that works. Thank you for your presentation. Members, questions? Well, we have this gentleman in the chair here. It's hard to get a hold of sometimes, but we're glad he's here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as a former member, I'm always glad to come.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. I just wanted to commend Commissioner McLaughlin and CTIB. I mean, members, I mean, think about all this work that's been done really in literally less than 3 years. It's really tremendous how far you've come in so short a period of time. So appreciate it as the legislature that gave you the charge to do this. Thank you for your work.
All right. For the comments or questions, you've left us speechless, apparently, Chair McLaughlin. Well, thank you for coming down. Members, I hope this is kind of sheds a little light on some of the things that are going on, particularly with Metro Transit. For those of you from Greater Minnesota, thank you for your patience and for paying attention to how this works, because your questions, your thought, your input is going to be very valuable as we move ahead. Friday, the Legislative Audit Commission will be receiving the report on transit governance issues, and then next week we'll have a look at it here in this committee, I think upstairs in Room 5 on Monday. So I do have one other little housekeeping item. We had MnDOT here a couple of days ago, and we were chatting about some things. Representative Hornstein had a question about percentages of expenditures on roads and bridges versus transit, and I had a question regarding federal revenue going to Greater Minnesota Transit, how much of that was subject to the vagaries of the budget, general fund, and so on and so forth. In other words, how much could be grabbed by budget people as things get towards the end of the session. We did get an email from our friends at MnDOT about that. You should have seen the box. Thank you, MnDOT, for responding to those questions. Further comments or questions? Go Steelers is all I have to say. Folks, we'll look forward to seeing you back here online.
Commissioner McLaughlin, also Western Pennsylvania.
All right. Must be good fertile ground over there. Go Steelers. Go Steelers. The meeting is adjourned.